now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, Gary Heseltine returns to the Cosmic Switchboard Show to talk about recent developments with the Capel Green documentary about RAF Bentwaters, Woodbridge, the Rendlesham Forest incident. It's gone by various names. And Gary is a veteran investigator of UFOs and has been deeply involved in investigating Bentwaters for many years. So without any further ado, Gary Heseltine, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thanks for having me back.
Gary, tell us about what you've been up to lately. Tell us how the documentary is progressing. I understand also, throwing a lot of questions at you at once, but I understand also that new witnesses, heretofore unknown, have come out in the recent past and have added more color, let's say, to the documentary.
That's a good opening question. Yeah, there are lots of developments going on that will inevitably result in the release of the film being put back. But I think the best way to phrase it is that it's a mixture of people that are known but are unexpected interviews that we didn't think were going to happen. So once the opportunity has arisen, we'd be pretty foolish not to pursue these. Now, I'm not going to go into detail on naming people at this stage because it's all very delicate and some interviews have been done, others are still to be done. But inevitably, what you've got to realise is that the knock-on effect is that you've got to get a film crew organised in the States. You've got to do various other things to get it all set up. And you also have to appreciate that Capel Green is a production that has turned from what was a relatively small-scale project to now a huge project covering the whole gamut of the case, many different aspects, the different sightings. And like with any journey or project, surprising things can happen along the way, and that's exactly what's happened. And it's turned from this small project into this huge project, and because we are aiming to do it at cinema level quality, with that comes a lot of additional skill sets that various people have on the production to get it up to that standard. And of course, when we aim for a cinema premiere, at least one cinema premiere, but to get it into a cinema, it has to be at certain standards. We hope to release it on wider streaming platforms. Each one has slightly different settings. And certainly in terms of like the editing, I'm not an editor, not at a professional standard. I've dabbled, but not at a professional standard, whereas Dion, the director, is. But he's doing it over and above his day-to-day work. None of us are getting paid. In fact, we've all put over the course of, two and a half years now, we've all put in thousands of pounds indirectly through travelling expenses, hotels, for film shoots, going out of our way to get this done. So realistically, the knock-on effect is it will put the date back for release into the new year. Not quite sure when. We haven't got a precise date. But it's the knock-on effect. But what I will say is we're not just doing these additional interviews, one or two reenactment additional filming sequences that inevitably when you start doing the editing process, you think, oh, we could do that shot there. That'll go with that shot. So you end up going back and just for being, I guess, from a point of view of trying to make it as good as it can be, you go back and you think, right, okay, we'll have to another film shoot there just to get that little sequence there. And again, it all takes time and setting up. So realistically, when we have said that the date will be in the new year, a lot of people actually have come out and said, take as long as it takes, just do a good job. And I think that is the attitude that we're taking, because we have in the past, over the last couple of years, of anticipated that it would be finished by now. But then things happen and you put the date back. So now I think we've got to the stage of saying, okay, rather than put a specific date out in a hope that it's going to be out by then, and now it's probably better off that we don't give a specific date or month. And it just happens when we're virtually there, because you know we don't want to disappoint people. But the attitude that we've experienced for all the changes that we're doing has been really positive. I can't think of any negative person that said, you know, you should be out now, blah blah blah. I think people are just saying, well, it looks really good. The trailer looks brilliant. Just do a good job, and so that's what we're aiming to do.
Yes, and I understand special emphasis was put on the special effects to make a lot of the actual imagery, the scenes, come to life on the big screen.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and anybody who's worked with special effects to any degree will realize that just rendering one complex shot may take days and weeks sometimes on the kind of equipment that we have. What I can say is that there are something like 15 to 20 specialist CGI effects that mix with live action shots that absolutely are all on location in the right places. And these are all part of telling the story of the whole event. Not just the Larry Warren, as some people suspect. It's the whole series of events and others that we've found along the way that play a part that are hitherto unknown.
Was some of this or a lot of this filmed on location?
It's all on location. It's absolutely all on location. You know, what you've got to realize is that the way the case has developed, the main case as we know it, as the public knows it, there are only a few absolutely nailed on locations, i.e. it's there. So the East Gate is a fixed point. So we all talk about the lights were seen near the East Gate on the first night kind of thing. That's a fixed position, so that stays in place. The other common feature that is mentioned and pinpointed is what's called the staging area, which is basically where on each of the nights of the events that the vehicles ended up going into the forest until they could go no further. And this is generally regarded as what's called the staging area. So that's a pretty much fixed point that everybody can agree on. But after that, the only other one that you can agree on is the Larry Warren field, Capel Green, as it's referred to, and the location of where he said something landed. Every other location, whether it be Holt's, Penistone's, Burroughs, is within a set period. Now, I've got Jim Penistone's book, and he kind of lays it out to the meter, but that's not where I have ever been shown by Colonel Holt, who took me around personally. So whether he's been given the wrong location, there's various locations, Dot Street and Brenda Butler, refer to another first night landing area, the landing area. But I've been with Holt, and Holt says, no, it's not there. It's way off in the forest. So I think in reality, most people won't appreciate this because they'll just listen in and will not have access to the location. There are very few fixed points of absolute agreement across the board. It's a very complicated case, as I no doubt many people realise, but it's actually more complex than probably any other case that I can think of.
Yes, and I imagine it would be a trick to arrange the documentary sequentially and thematically, because, as you know, Gary, it took place over a number of nights, so there would have to be a process of weeding out. Well, we only have so much time. We have to include this particular event. What was some of the criteria that you all had to kind of come together to determine upon which events and which individuals to focus on?
Well, I think the real answer there is that when we originally started the project, like I said, it was relatively small. It was after a chance meeting that Dion Johnson, the director of the film, had with Larry Warren. They didn't know each other at all, but he knew of Larry Warren. He knew of his story. But they had a chance encounter actually in Rendlesham Forest, because it's now a like a tourist walkway through the forest kind of thing. And there's generally hundreds of people out there at any one time, especially during the summer months. And it's a, you know, 2 or 3 miles square or something like that. So you could be anywhere on that and never bump into anybody, but they happened to bump into each other. He approached Larry and said, "Are you Larry Warren?" Larry Warren said, "Yes." And then basically he had a camera with him. He said, "Oh, can I just do a quick interview with you there and then?" And he said, "Yeah, okay." And then he said after that, "I'd like to make a documentary about you." And that's kind of weird in itself, the odds that they meet up. They could have been anywhere distant, and Larry doesn't live anywhere near Rendlesham Forest. He lives 200 miles away. So the odds of them being there at the same time, all that kind of thing, the synchronicity is quite weird. But anyway, that's what happened, and so I think Larry said yes. So I think originally it was just, well, let's tell the Larry Warren story. I was then approached to become the lead researcher, co-writer, and I said, well, really, we should be looking to do the whole case, because if we're going to do it, we might as well do it properly. And Dion agreed with that. So then you then start setting the parameters that are actually much wider. So then, like, as you just said, you then have to identify the people that you, whose story you're going to tell, which bit's going to be CGI, which live action interviews are you going to do. So I think the simplest way to describe it is there are two distinct timelines in the film. The first one is the Larry Warren, Capel Green scenario, aliens in the field, Colonel Williams, that kind of thing, and it's all being filmed. So you've got that story being told, i.e. Larry's story being told through various interviews with different people, and I'll not go into those. And then you've then got the second dovetail story, which is the all the other relevant main events that are kicking in sort of every third or fourth scene from that initial Larry Warren story. So it, there's two timelines dovetail together, telling the whole event, and hopefully done in a very poignant, realistic way that's never been done before. I mean, there's been well over 50-odd documentaries made, but very few have had decent special effects. Very few have done it with no agenda to just tell other than the truth. I've done many TV documentaries, and I often say this, is that you, TV, they've got their own agenda, i.e. some company has been given a budget to make a program for X TV company, and the program will look like this, and they stick to that agenda. And it comes out with a definite bias, usually one way or the other, or just to leave it as the status quo. Very few documentaries have been made, I can't think of any really, that are truly independent to the point of saying, well, there's just the facts, and give you as many of the salient facts as possible. TV makes entertainment. It doesn't necessarily give you the truth. It's a different medium. They are in it to make a program, and their remit is different from actually telling the truth. They don't lie to you. They do it by omission. They just don't give you all the facts. And then when you start delving into the case, and then you you come across things that you think, surely that's in the public interest. Well, you know, why haven't investigative journalists brought that out on a computer, in a documentary? And there are literally dozens of those facts surrounding this case that I, as a former police detective and someone who was, you know, qualified to deal with serious and complex crime, investigate serious and complex crime, when I look at many of these things, I think, wow, why has that never been on a documentary? You know, and we're talking over 50-odd documentaries over the years, you know, from all around the world, different companies have made them. And yet, none of them actually feature many of these, what I think are absolutely huge things that I think should be shown to the public. And what becomes clear, and this is why it's a complicated case, what becomes clear is the level of media manipulation, the way certain people within the case have almost become allowed to become the public face of the event, and really nobody else gets a look in. The TV companies are basically only interested in Holt, Peniston and Burrows. Initially, Larry Warren was covered a lot because he was the original military whistleblower. And what I mean by that is he was the first person to actually give his name and go on camera. Initially under Art Wallace, a pseudonym given to him by Larry Fawcett, a Connecticut detective. But he quickly went on camera and said, "My name's Larry Warren." Now, other people will say, "Oh no, the other guy was the Steve Roberts, the guy who was the informant to Brenda Butler." Well, this guy used a pseudonym, but never went public, and so to this day has never gone public. So, to my mind, a whistleblower is somebody who says, "Actually, my name's Gary Esseltine, my name's Larry Warren, my name's Edward Snowden," and they put themselves out there, kind of thing. And the fact that this guy always used a pseudonym and to this day still does means that for me he may have given information, and that's not in doubt. But how can you be a whistleblower if you don't actually give your name? It's a mute point, but that for me, the first original military whistleblower is Larry Warren, because he was the first one to say, "My name is Larry Warren," and go on camera. But anyway, so you've got that aspect, and the complications are that over the last 20 years or so, 25 years, the media, in terms of TV, have heavily shaped the way the case is perceived by just basically limiting it to three main players, Holt, Peniston and Burrows. And that is a mistake, because the public are not, in these documentaries, are not being given more facts about some of the other stuff that is actually, when you look at it, very pertinent to the case.
And since then, there's been these other non-entities who've made an appearance, like Nick Pope and others, who've presented themselves as being experts on the case. And that's a very good point you make, Gary, because up till now, we have Charles Holt, Burrows, Peniston. We really only get one point of view. And in the background is all this incessant trolling and slandering of Larry Warren to demonize him to the point where, for someone who doesn't know any better, they would just assume that, oh, well, he's not credible. Let's pay attention to Holt, Burrows, and Peniston again. And so what I want to know also, now that you brought him up, because they do figure in the story, I take it at some level they're going to be portrayed, and at some level perhaps some of their interviews or comments will be featured in this. Or correct me if I'm wrong, or perhaps not.
Well, what you've got there, we initially, in the early stages, asked all three to take part, and all three declined. on the, virtually the same kind of wording that this, you know, we were just making a Larry Warren fraud, which is ridiculous. And let's just nail this one to the mast. You know, why would I put my professional reputation on the line if I've got one? I went public in 2002 while I was still a serving police detective, created the police database. That brought me a lot of media attention. So that's how I became known within the field. I then had a 7-year collaboration period with Colonel Charles Holt between 2007 and 2014, having initially met when I was a guest on the UFO Hunters program, which was a series. It was series one. It ran for three series. Bill Burns and his crew came over from the States, and I got involved in that about Reynolds. So that's when I first became publicly involved in the Reynolds case, which was December 2007, when I met Colonel Holt for the first time. We had a really good rapport for many years, and I worked on trying to develop a film script of the ensemble case, as it were. I ended that relationship in end of 2014, early 2015, when he began telling me that he had a source who he didn't name to me, who would finally dish the dirt on Larry Warren and bury him once and for all. I mean, that's kind of how he was talking. And I said, fine, if you've got the evidence to put it out there. I said, but you can't just say it, you know, when you do a lecture. You've got to back it up with the actual evidence in writing, etc., to prove documents, etc., etc. And he did that on a couple of occasions, and neither time did he produce any evidence to substantiate. It was all based on essentially one person's claims. And when I looked at those claims, they didn't add up, and it was a distortion of the truth, wild distortion of the truth, very clever manipulation of the facts. But it didn't add up to scrutiny as I was looking at it through police eyes, as it were. And when I pointed that out, I'd warned him once, and when he did it again on a UK lecture in, I think, June, July of 2015, I didn't attend. I originally was going to attend, but by then it was clear that he was going to pursue on this line, and I said it's unprofessional, and so I ended my association. So I know Colonel Holt very, very well, especially through our email conversation, which I only met him twice because obviously he lived in the States and I lived in the UK. But we had a very good rapport, and we had many, many emails over those 7 years, which obviously I still have, as he does too, which clearly will show that. Had the evidence have been damning on forensic examination against Larry Warren, then I would have said, well, put it out there and go with it, and backed him all the way. But it didn't. The thing was, at that time, I'd met Larry Warren on several occasions at various conferences, but we weren't close. You know, he was just somebody I'd met. I met lots of people. I'd always found him and his retelling of his story compelling, and I'd always believed it. But obviously, when I was working in that 7-year collaboration with Colonel Holt, he was very much along the lines of, well, Larry Warren was worked on, which is not in doubt. Interrogated, he was given drugs, like others were, Jim Pennison for one. Basically, he was fed a false narrative. They implanted false memories, i.e. the Cape of Grease scenario, the aliens in the field, the landing craft, Colonel Williams, and it all being filmed kind of thing. That he said, was implanted. And originally, because I was in that close collaboration period with him, obviously, I'm going to side with him. I didn't have any close association to Larry Warren. So I kind of accepted that. And why wouldn't I? Because here I am meeting somebody that's arguably, at that time, I thought was the most important person in the entire case because of his high military rank. It's, you know, it was a privilege for me to get involved. And so initially you go into this thinking that everything is hunky-dory and this guy is an absolute straight-up guy. Sadly, over the 7 years of our collaboration, I began to realize that he knew a lot more than he was telling me. And I, at various times, I'd also seen that he would stir things up between John Burroughs, Jim Pennison, John Burroughs in particular. And there was like this, I won't say love-hate, but there was definitely, he would stir things up from time to time over the years. And I couldn't see why he was doing that. It was almost as if he was acting almost at the behest of others to stir the mud on the waters occasionally, which I couldn't quite understand. So anyway, when the relationship ended, this coincided with the rise of these claims, and in the UK, a rise in a small group of people that came together, four in particular in the UK that I regard as trolls, who started what was very clearly a public campaign to discredit Larry Warren. So this is like late, middle, probably 2016 onwards for sure, that these four people came together, and very vociferous. Now, why do I call them trolls? Well, it's dead simple. If you, in order to win your argument, if you have to call somebody an F this and an F that, and literally just start besmirching somebody's name, then to my mind, you've lost the argument. Their arguments on their claims do not stand up to scrutiny. They're a clever twisting of the facts. But a lot of people are taken in these days and don't do their own due diligence. People are actually very reliant now on social media. If it's on Facebook, it has to be real. If it's on Instagram, it has to be real, you know. But in reality, nothing could be further from the truth. If it's on YouTube, it has to be real. Oh no, it doesn't. And that is the case with these people. But anybody that disagreed with them, then you are then subjected to a level of abuse that's F this, F that, you know. And like in my case, as soon as I came out randomly and looked at these initial claims that went on in 2016, and I said, well, I've always found Larry Warren's account compelling, and I was an advanced interviewer of suspects and witnesses. I'm pretty good at reading non-verbal communications, NVCs, and I'd had training in out of the psychology of interviewing. I always found his case very compelling. So when I publicly went and said, well, actually, I believe Larry Warren, and I don't think there's any doubt based on all the evidence that's been out there over the 30-odd years up to that point that he was there in the field. Complicated though that is, there is evidence that puts him there through the likes of Adrian Bustinza, Greg Batram, et cetera, at that point. And I said that, I then suddenly become a target for the trolls, and the trolls, because they use personal abuse. Someone has to use, is for me, a troll is somebody who uses personal abuse to further their aims, and all of these do that in abundance. So I then became a liar, a con man, and a fraud. The magazine, which has some of the most respected people in the world contributing every issue, it became, it's a publication for liar, fraud, con man, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, the way social media is you can literally say anything on Facebook, for example, and I'm particularly a downer on Facebook because it's such a huge platform and there aren't the regulatory constraints that there should be, and it's all right to call people an F in this, an F in that, and it isn't in my view, and I have never resorted to using such language or such tactics to try to win an argument. Like I said earlier, if you've got to do that, you've lost the argument, and so there is only one side doing the trolling, and it ain't me. But of course they can, because the Facebook laws are so weak, they can literally say anything, and this is wrong. And so I'm one of these people who has, in a way, privately been campaigning for a restructuring. Yes, they will take action against, race hate, sexual crime, that kind of thing. But just common decency and being allowed to call somebody a fraud Now, if somebody calls somebody a fraud, then it says to me as an ex-policeman that you've got a conviction for fraud. And yet you haven't. So, but people still say it. But you see what I mean? How dangerous it is when the systems platforms are so weak, they're probably 5 years behind in the way that they police these things. And eventually, I think this will get tackled. And you can, you know, in the UK, there was an MP that was shot and stabbed and murdered. And most of the MPs, because of all the shenanigans going on over Brexit, which is obviously relevant to the UK about leaving the European community, it's created tremendous debate and division in the country, you know, but MPs are getting death threats, you know, on social media. That's not acceptable. And so this is why, in a sense, these people who otherwise would never have been given a platform in the days before social media, of now anybody can have a radio show, anybody can do a podcast, anybody can have a YouTube channel. It's kind of just given license to some of the sickest people in the world to have a voice that they wouldn't have necessarily had. It gives them a platform. So anyway, in light of that, that campaign was clear. And as soon as I said I was getting involved with the Capel Green and that I was going to be supporting Larry Warren, supporting the investigation and where it went, and that I believed his account, I then become a target, which is very wearing, something that I'd never experienced up until that point, never really had any criticism, and then suddenly you're a con man and you're a liar just for supporting somebody. So that's how that went, but it got more sinister because you then realise the wider politics involved, the source of Colonel Holt's book in the Holt Perspective, his first book published by John Snahanson. The source of that material on Larry Warren was the same source as the leader of the Trolls. And that was the source he told me about, who's going to dig the dirt and whatever. So let me put this in perspective, that the leader of the Trolls, this woman, very clever, very manipulative, quite a good writer if she stuck to just writing fact, but she has twisted everything, but people don't do the due diligence and they think all this material that she puts out, it looks quite impressive initially, but has no substance when you actually examine it. But people don't examine it, and that's the problem. It seems a lot of material, and on the surface of it people just go, oh wow, yeah, oh, that's really damning. But actually, when you look into it, it isn't, and it's a twisting of the facts.
Do you mean that Charles Holt himself was endorsing
directly linked to the leader of the Trolls? Yes.
Wow.
and not only him. Not only him. So was Nick Pope. Nick Pope.
Oh, really?
Nick Pope. Yeah, absolutely. I've got written evidence that proves this. Through their own Facebook communications, I've got screen grabs. Where Holt's talking to the leader of the Trolls and the other Trolls. I have confirmation. In fact, I did not know initially who Colonel Holt's source was for the Holt Perspective, for the alleged dirt on Larry Warren. I then became aware that it was the leader of this woman, who the leader of the Trolls. So she actually put a screen grab out saying, I've just received my copy. I only did the bit on Larry Warren. So she said it herself and put it out on a screen grab. So there you go, with holding a copy of the book that had been sent to her by Nick Pope and inscribed. But the Nick Pope gets involved in early 2017 when suddenly he puts out a comment, totally unexpected, saying that had I still been in the police, I should probably be arrested for perpetrating a hoax on the UFO community. So I was like, what? Where does this come from? Now, prior to that, I'd worked on several documentaries with Nick Pope. I'd met him many times over the years. Never had a wrong word with him up until January 2017. And so this came totally out of the blue. But that's what he was saying. Basically, I should be arrested for perpetrating a hoax on the UFO community. Now, whilst I wouldn't say we were ever friends, because I never really trusted him, but we were affable and respectful of each other. And we'd even had dinner together on a couple of occasions. Just the two of us sat opposite each other, so never a problem up to that point. So then when he came out with this, that was a bit of a surprise initially, and then you look at the wider context, and Nick Pope has played a very curious role, or a significant role, and curious, in the whole of the Rendlesham story, because for those that aren't aware, he really began to surface around 2000 with the release of Georgina Bruni's book, You Can't Tell the People, which is a pretty good book. And he was heavily involved in a lot of the pre-publicity tour, book tour and things like that. And he's really been prominent in Rendlesham since around 2000. So someone who I had met, had dinner with, never had a word, suddenly is joining in the trolls and has been in active discussion with the trolls, and I can prove all of that. And so you have Colonel Holt. When we actually asked Colonel Holt to take part in Capel Green, his response was, it's a fraud on the UFO community, and you should go to this person. And so he names the person, the leader of the trolls. So we have it the other way. So confirmation both ways. She'd said it, and then he confirms it. Nick Pope, then his role has got more and more sinister as time has gone on, because he's obviously embedded within the UFO community in America. He's an absolute regular on the American UFO conference circuit, and has been literally since, last 10, 15 years at least, but probably 20 plus years since he went public. And so he is very well established in America, lives there. And I became aware, and it's now happened on two occasions, where researchers who know me from overseas, who I've met and are friends, have sent me privately emails where Nick Pope is emailing prominent UFO researchers, predominantly in the United States, saying that I'm involved in a scam, saying that Capel Green is a scam, saying that Capel Green is a hoax on the UFO community. He's actually going and putting out things. And here's the thing. Has he ever spoken to me about it directly? No. Now, wouldn't you have thought that someone who you had known, if they had any serious concerns about the project, would have emailed me or rang me and said, Gary, we've known each other a long time, blah, blah, blah. What's this with Capel Green? Isn't this hasn't this been proven as a hoax? And had he have done that, I would have then said, well, no, it hasn't, and whatever. But that's what you would have expected from a reasonable person. But clearly, he chose not to do that and has joined in the very definite, easy-to-prove campaign to try to discredit Larry Warren. And to be fair, at the point I began to get involved in, nearly succeeded. At the point I became involved in, it was a bit like, and I think I said at the time, it was akin to a lynch mob mentality. It was frenzied, and it was very unsettling, because when people are rounding on somebody, and yet when you examined what they were saying, which is what I did, and it doesn't add up, then, it's literally a campaign to destroy somebody. And at one point in one of her screen grabs that she puts out, her mission is to destroy Larry Warren. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this leader of the trolls, this woman. She had met Larry Warren on several occasions, but predominantly she had been a his number one fan, and I mean number one, an obsessive number one fan, through the internet for many years. I think at least seven. I think she will claim nine, but I think Larry will say it's about seven. And they actually only met very late on into that 7 or 9 years, depending on whose perspective you listen to. But suffice to say, she was an obsessive fan. For example, she would ring up radio shows and say, get Larry Warren on. Get Larry Warren. He's the best person in the whole of the Rendlesham Forest case. He's the only really main witness. Get him on the show. And she would badger radio show hosts. For example, this was demonstrated to me by Joe Montaldo, who obviously American, has his own radio station. And he said this. He said, yeah, she badgered me until I had him on the show. And then when I had him on the show, I thought he was a good guest and became friends with Larry Warren. And he remains friends with Larry Warren. So that's kind of where she comes from. And then around 2015, 2016, something happens from her perspective, which we don't know what really flips her. But there is a complete 180-degree change. From being the obsessive number one fan, she is now the obsessive number one, I'm going to destroy you. And that, whichever way you look at that, that kind of extreme, to go from extreme left to extreme right in one quick swerve, for most people would probably send alarm signals out that this is not kind of normal behavior. And it is extreme to go from one perspective so wild on one side to then so diametrically opposed to the other spectrum. And so that's what you got. And this woman is on a mission to destroy. And she actually says it in one of her own scripts. My mission is to destroy Larry Warren. And she did a pretty good job until I got involved. And then I kind of deconstructed it. But because the way social media works, and because there are no rules, basically, there are rules, but they're not really good rules. They're very weak rules. They're allowed to get away with it. And so she reported to Hull, confirmed both ways. Nick Pope then joined in 2017. So it really begins 2016. And then Nick Pope joins in increasing frequency from 2017. And I got lots of screen grabs of Nick Pope where he's involved with the trolls. And this is someone who, if you saw him on telly, would be oh so really softly spoken and the typical English guy, butter wouldn't melt in my mouth kind of thing. And yet secretly he is in league, and there's no other way to put it, he is supporting in league with both Holt, who doesn't get directly involved in these kind of like Facebook conversations, but we know from his confirmation to us that she was the source, and from her screen grab saying that she was the source to his whole perspective. But that's nailed on. But with Nick Pope does engage with the trolls on an active basis. So the fact that these people are involved with people who are spreading vile, false narratives to people, it for me is obscene. And you know, people will look and think, "Oh, Nick Pope can't be. This guy's white and white, as it were." Well, I'm sorry, he isn't. And we asked Nick Pope to get involved, and he declined. And in fact, I can tell you about an incident that occurred when he came to the UK. I think it was 2017. He came to the UK as a lecture guest for a big event in Manchester called the Awakenings Conference. And he was one of the speakers. And I was there in the capacity of I get a stall there for the magazine, so UFO Truth magazine stall. So I didn't get involved in this, but Dion Johnson approached Nick, and initially he had said to a mutual friend of ours, yeah, I'll give you 5 minutes for an interview. And then as soon as Dion Johnson approached him and said, "My name's Dion Johnson. I'm the director of Capel Green." He then, like a rabbit in headlights, said, "I don't want to talk about it. Stop the interview." And off he went, as quick as that. Now, this is a man who'd publicly said that we're perpetrating a hoax. So we were going to give him a platform to say why. But he didn't want to know. He just literally rabbit in headlights ran away. And that's the kind of person you're dealing with Nick Pope. He's got a voice because he's an American. He's got a massive following because he has become the go-to guy literally for TV documentaries. Now, what you've got to consider is what harm is being done behind the scenes. And if I hadn't have been tipped off twice by people that he was writing to via email to prominent UFO researchers trying to besmirch not only the documentary but my name, because I'm obviously linked to it, why would I perpetrate a hoax? Why would I jump off a cliff and commit professional suicide? It's ridiculous. I'm only interested in the truth, but I'm not afraid to put out the truth if it's there. And I said to Holt many years ago, if you've got the evidence on Larry Warren, it stands up to scrutiny, you put it out. Evidence falls where it falls, but it has to stand up to scrutiny, and that's where it falls down. But that's the situation that you have. You have and then you have kind of side shoots from that, because as I widen this campaign to discredit, over the years, and anybody who's followed the case will realize that there's been major problems between Colonel Holt and John Burroughs, because for over 20 years, he denied that John Burroughs went forward after Holt came back in, and then admitted it about 25, 26 years later. So that had always been a big bone of contention. So you could argue that Colonel Holt had lied for 20 odd years. If you're in a court of law, I think that would amount to a lie for all those years, and then suddenly admitted it on a show, and that caused further friction. But at least he'd recognise that John had an experience on what we regard as Holt's night with Adrian Bastinza after Holt come back in with his team. But then you have the other prominent person, Jim Penniston. He did a book with Nick Pope and John Burroughs. And in a sense, the book was initially put out as, this is going to be John and Jim's story. But actually, when you look at the book Encountering Rendlesham Forest by Nick Pope, there's something like 21 chapters, and only three relate to Jim and John. The rest is just a straightforward rehashing. So this is not their intimate story. And obviously, from that, there's been a massive fallout. Jim Penniston and John Burroughs have gone completely opposite. And I'm reading Jim Penniston's book now for research purposes, I might add. And I'm amazed at the tone of Jim Penniston's book, because he puts down John Burroughs very publicly in his book on at least 50 occasions. Generally repeating much of the same account each time, but they're there. And is that the way you write books, just calling people and trying to belittle them? That's not how I think you should write books. It should be based on the facts, not put downs and slurs. And there is huge slurs on John Burroughs' character all the way along. As I might add, that I feature in the book very late on in the book, and he clearly doesn't have any opinion of me either. Derogatory comments about me too. But he also gets his facts wrong. He says that he only met me once. Well, actually, we'd met twice, and the incidents he's referring to were the second time. He completely forgets the first time that we met at the airport when he was with John Burroughs, when my wife and I saw them at the airport. And I went over because I'd never met Jim Penniston at that point. I'd had a few emails. I'd met John, obviously, several years earlier in 2010, and we got on really well at that point. I went across with my wife, say hello, introduce myself to Jim. And you'd have thought I was a leper. And their attitude towards me, John included, which absolutely shocked me, because we'd shared a big suite at the Harrington Hotel in Washington in 2010 when we met. And we got on really, really well. We talked for hours and hours. We were both enthusiastic about the case. You know, we got on really well. And then suddenly, 3 years later, for the citizens' hearings, which is when we met, when I met John for the second time, and when I met Jim Pennison for the first time at the airport with my wife, I reached out to shake hands, and I was enthusiastic to see John. And both of them looked at me as like I was a leper, and literally, reluctantly, as it appeared to me, put out their hands to shake hands. You know, the body language was like, don't want to know you. And that surprised me particularly with John, because nothing had changed during that time. From my point of view, but the body language is completely off. And my wife witnessed this, and that's when I first met Jim Pennison. Well, according to Jim Pennison in his book, we met later at the citizens' hearings. And he's, as I say, he's not very complimentary about me, which is fine. But what I'm saying is, if he is inaccurate about that and doesn't mention the first time we actually met, then I think it says to me is how accurate is the rest, if you can get that basic fact wrong. And on the basis of some of the book, some of it is very detailed, but there's a lot of stuff coming out there that was never mentioned by Jim Pennison at the time and over the 30-odd years. The binary codes is another issue. I have real reservations about the binary codes. I had a long Facebook conversation with Gary Osborne 6-9 months ago, and I basically said, you know, this is a standalone account, and there is nobody there out there corroborating his account, which didn't come out until 2010.
Could you enlighten me, Gary? What are the binary codes?
Well, what happens is that nobody knew anything of the binary codes in the public world until 2010, and the 30th anniversary of the event. So 2010, and there'd been a big conference organized where Jim, John, Nick Pope, Peter Robbins, Larry Warren, Linda Moulton Howe were there at a conference in Woodbridge Community Hall, which is the closest town to Rendlesham, only a small town. But it was there to corroborate, to celebrate the 30th anniversary. And suddenly at this conference, which was filmed by someone, I don't know who, but there is a video, fortunately, in existence so that you can look up on YouTube. And Jim Pennison suddenly tells the audience, I've got a new revelation for you. When I touched the craft and walked around it, when I touched the symbols, he got a alleged download of information passed to him. And afterwards, when he got home, he couldn't sleep and he had to write it down. And it was written down like on an automatic writing of zeros and ones. And he wrote page and page of zeros and ones, didn't think anything to it, took the pages out, put them to the back of his pocketbook, and kind of forgot all about it. And yet, when they were making, in October of 2010, during the making of a Ancient Aliens program, suddenly one of the production staff is alleged to have gone through his pocketbook and suddenly noticed these pages of zeros and ones and said, what is that? And he said, I don't know what it is, apparently. And this apparently was witnessed by John Burroughs. And I think the production member says, oh, this is binary code. Kind of like, what's binary code? And cutting a long story short, he then told the audience in 2010 that he'd had some specialists look at the pages of zeros and ones, and apparently it was a message and he put it out as a message of basically time travelers from the future coming back to the Earth, you know, and they mention, I think, seven geographical map coordinates around the Earth, and basically it's this wild, incredible story of time travel from the future. But he never mentioned this to anyone. And in fact, he didn't mention this to the person who was with him in the forest. The one person he surely could have told, who he'd been with on that extraordinary night of the landing on the first night, was John Burroughs, and he never said anything. And then suddenly he comes out with this account and then expects everybody to believe him, when the audience was actually very critical, started asking him a lot of hard questions. And clearly, if you watch that video, which is out on YouTube, you can see that he really gets a hard time from the audience, who are shocked, like, well, why have you waited 30 years? And basically, Jim Pennison would say, well, who could I tell? Well, I can understand he couldn't tell his bosses. I can understand that. But he could have told John Burroughs. Didn't say anything. Never mentioned the pages. But in the subsequent few weeks after the release of that, after that sudden announcement in December 2010, he made lots of inconsistent remarks, like there's 6 pages, there's 10 pages, there's 12 pages. Well, I think I would know. Wouldn't you know? Something as devastating as that, something as profound as that, don't you think you would know how many pages you had? And the fact that he went on radio shows and he didn't, and then he would say things like, I knew what it meant when I touched, and I kind of knew what it meant then. And yet he couldn't read binary. He still can't read binary. And yet he was giving conflicting accounts. So it's a really, I think, suspicious. And going back to the Gary Osborne, who is the co-writer of the Jim Pennison book, in fact, he's written most of it. You can tell through the phraseology that he's written it basically from his perspective and his association with Jim Pennison. And they start to go off into the binary codes in a big way. And there is a second book, I believe, coming out soon, entirely devoted to all of this. Yet at the end of that conversation, he admitted that it was a purely standalone account. And I said, well, in the same way that Larry Warren submitted himself to a polygraph examination, a modern polygraph, which is tough, 94 to 98% accurate, something like that. I think to gain really any kind of credence, he has to submit the paper and ink for testing, which he says he's done, but hasn't, as far as I can see, produced any written evidence from a lab to support that or to corroborate that, but for some kind of corroboration that he should undertake a lie detector test to see whether in fact the story of the binary codes and is real or not, because I have real reservations whether it is. Personally, if you were looking at for me as a detective, I would say it's very suspicious that they were in some way made up. And I've said this before, but you know, if you're going to make such a huge claim of time travel as from the future, and we are to, it's the most important message, which he subsequently says in his book that the binary codes are the most important thing in Rendlesham Forest. It's the most important thing for humanity. Well, if you're going to make
that's a pretty bold statement, yeah,
absolutely. If you are going to make such grandiose statements, you should have some kind of corroboration to back that up. And as far as I can see, there is none whatsoever. And here's the irony. There is corroboration to Larry Warren's account of the Cape of Green's aliens landed craft historically out there. So his is not a standalone account, as some people would have you believe. There is corroboration. But here we go. You know, the binary codes, people are going, yeah, we'll just accept that. TV companies, well, oh, yeah. We'll make entertainment. We'll tell this story. Without any corroboration whatsoever.
It has all the hallmarks, Gary, of a red herring. What's interesting, too, is I recall this. It was one of those documentary-type TV shows where they were doing a segment on Rendlesham, and they were filming Pennison. He was sitting there. He was under hypnosis, And I think that was one of the first times he put the meme out of, oh, they're from the future, right? And then later, it comes out this yarn about the binary codes, which seems to have taken on a life of its own.
Correct. And you've got to ask why. But it is an interesting fact. He claimed in 2010, when the story, he made it public at that conference, that he didn't know what binary code was. And yet, in 1998, Linda Moulton Howe had published a book called Glimpses of Other Realities. And he was working with Linda Moulton Howe at the time of that conference, interestingly, where that book includes a segment, a partial transcript of a hypnosis session that Jim Pennison had in 1994. Well, in the book, Glimpses of Other Realities, and I have a copy of that book, which she gave me, coincidentally, talk about synchronicity, that there is a section that basically starts off with the phrase, this is a partial transcript, so words to the effect of, somebody is saying to Jim Pennison, can you see the binary codes? Now, that's not an open question. That's a closed question. That's giving you information. Can you see, that's directing somebody, can you see the binary codes, yay or nay? That's not an open question. And so you could argue that maybe when he was being interrogated, which is not in doubt, he was implanted with a false memory.
That's a very good point. You know, what's interesting, and I'll leave this, parting thought for the end of a very enlightening and interesting first segment, Gary. What a motley crew of characters that are swirling in and around. You know, where there's smoke, there's fire. As we get closer to the release of Capital Green, the shills and the trolls become more venomous, more spiteful. And I need to remind, my listeners are pretty sharp and switched on, but it bears repeating that whenever these memes are bruited about and they have a high emotional component attached to them, we must always be wary of those. So for example, I've come across people who presume to be in our UFO field that make all these claims like, oh yeah, Rendlesham, that's a hoax, a general kind of blanket statement. And it's clear to me that they've been tainted, as it were, Gary, by some of these trolls out there.
Lot of them have been taken in.
Oh yeah. And then when the name Larry Warren is thrown out there, then they just fly off the handle. Oh yeah, he's been proven to be a blah, blah, blah. And again, it's highly emotionally driven, and this seems to plug into an aspect or an element of these people's characters that buy into that. It's a very interesting psychological study. But anyhow, we reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guest, Gary Heseltine. We've got a whole other segment to go. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.